Would please turn to the letter to the Hebrews. Going to attempt to do something completely foolish today, and that is to try to survey Hebrews in roughly 35 minutes. This may not work out. We'll try. In terms of the book of Hebrews, there's a few things that are unknown, that whenever you approach the book of Hebrews, you're going to be in for a trial if you want to try to figure out. For the most part, outside of those couple things, the book's fairly straightforward as a whole. Those couple things being who and when was this, who wrote it and when did he write it, assuming it was a he. And there's some passages about apostasy that typically make people in the Reformed tradition uncomfortable. Those are pretty much your two things. In terms of who, I have no idea who. Traditionally, as you all know, and it used to be thought that Paul wrote it, and that's what you'll see in your King James Version Bible. Maybe he did. Maybe he didn't. When? Also, a valid question. I actually think it was written before the destruction of Jerusalem, and I have a reason for that. And if we have time, which we won't, then maybe we'll talk about it a little bit. We'll see. What's that? His Bible knows, though, it was written in AD 64. So I agree with his Bible, at least on that. AD 64. That's a good time frame. Whoever this is was at least in the general circles of Paul. Okay, we know that. If you look at the very end of the book, very last chapter, chapter 13, verse 22, I appeal to you, brothers, bear with my word of exhortation, for I have written to you briefly. You should know that our brother Timothy has been released, with whom I shall see you if he comes soon. Assuming this is the same Timothy, that is the Timothy of the Pauline letters and of Acts, then whoever this is probably related, at least in some way, to those ministries. And another reason why is, next verse, greet all your leaders and all the saints, those who come from Italy, send you greetings. Okay? So whoever this is, he knows Timothy, all right, and is from around Italy, very much within the general sphere. I mean, in theory, you could have an apostle or somebody who could have gone a completely different direction, like, for example, India. That would not be in the same sphere as Paul and Timothy. That's a very different part of the world. Whoever this is from that area. And so that means you've got some characters that it could be. It could be Barnabas. It could be Apollos. It could be Paul. It's definitely not Timothy, obviously. Okay, so nobody knows for sure. And the other thing is, there are some passages about apostasy. Now, if we think about one of his main goal here, in this book, is essentially to say that what has come through Jesus and Jesus himself is greater than anything that has ever come before. Okay? That is the general gist of the book. Apostasy, all right, comes up as a topic and is very relevant for him as a topic because he's contrasting new and old. Because in the old, apostasy was a problem. And one of his fundamental contrasts is, if Jesus is better than Moses, and people didn't listen to Moses, and they got punished, what do you think happens when they don't listen to Jesus? It's got to be worse. That's basically the topic. So that, there are some questions about how you would fit this in with what would generally come up as a preservation of the saints, or a once-saved-always-saved worldview that you'll see within the Reformed. The author of Hebrews is not particularly concerned with that topic. He is warning people, do not apostatize, and is not particularly concerned with trying to harmonize himself with the Gospel of John or Paul. And so that is left to us who want to draw the big picture. Now, in terms of drawing the big picture, this is, you could totally see this as trying to solve a lot of the same problems that Romans is trying to solve, or Galatia. But it's more like Romans, in the sense that Romans is a more general letter of, here's a general overview of what God is doing in Jesus, in contrast to what God is fulfillment of what God was doing through Moses. It's very much this. It's not like Galatia. There's not a particular problem. there's a lot of talk about apostasy, but it's not a particular person's apostasy, or a particular small subgroup of people who are causing issues. That's Galatia. So with all that in mind, meaning whoever it is, they at least knew Paul. They had to. They were in those same circles. And around Paul's ministry, Timothy was there. Let's take a look at the book. It starts off, it's worth reading the first paragraph, which I bet all of you, or at least adults, have read multiple times. Long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God, in the exact imprint of his nature, and he upholds the universe by the word of his power. After making purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. All right. Having become as much superior to angels as the name he has inherited is more excellent than theirs. This first paragraph, you could totally repeat this and contrast himself with Moses later on. But the first thing he's going to talk about is angels. Now let's think about first century Christianity. First century Christianity, looking back, you can look for some heroes, or you can look at some things that are pretty spectacular. There's a general belief that the law was given to Moses, was mediated through angels. And if you look back at the Old Testament, angels are a very powerful force, okay? So if you're going to compare Jesus with the old, angels make sense as something you want to compare him against. Is he greater than those very powerful spiritual beings? And the answer is yes. And what's the basis of his argument? His basis is the Old Testament. If you look at the following bits, all the way essentially to the end of the chapter, you'll see essentially his argument. Okay? Verse 5, "For to which of the angels did God ever say, 'You are my son, today I've begotten you'?'" Okay? Who did he say that to? What's that? Not to the angels. This is in the Psalms, all right? Who was the son of God? Well, David, in a sense, was the son of God, right? And so Jesus, as the David par excellence, he was called something that angels were not really. Or, "I will be a father to him, and he shall be a son, and let all of God's angels worship him." So whoever this is, all right, the angels are focused toward him. But when he talk about the angels, he says, well, in verse 7, "He makes angels winds and his ministers a flame of fire." So they're not exalted. They're not kingly. They're basically ministering spirits. Okay? So Jesus is greater than angels, because God calls the king, Jesus, son. Angels, they're servants. Now in chapter 2, you get your first discussion of apostasy. All right, and it's pretty simple. "Therefore, we must pay closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away from it. For since the message declared by angels proved to be reliable, and every transgression or disobedience received a just retribution, how shall we escape if we neglect such a great salvation?" All right, what's the argument? If the angels were right, and it was bad to reject and not listen to them, to ignore Jesus, to reject him, is much, much worse. Verse 5, "For it was not to angels that God subjected the world to come, of which we are speaking." Okay? Who was it? It was to Jesus. It was to the Davidic king. He doesn't spend a lot of time on angels. At the end of chapter 2, he's now going to transition. And most of the rest of his contrast is in some way about people from the Old Testament. The first one is going to be Moses. All right. "Therefore, holy brothers," this is chapter 3, "you who share in a heavenly calling, consider Jesus the apostle and high priest of our confession, who was faithful to him who appointed him, just as Moses was also faithful in all God's house. For Jesus has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses, as much more glory as the builder of a house has more honor than the house itself." Okay? What's the basic contrast? What's the basic idea here? Moses, all right, Moses was given a house. Jesus built the house. Okay, Moses, I guess you could say, there is the house, and then there is the builder of the house. Who's more powerful? Well, who's more significant? It's the builder of the house, not the house. The house is the output of the builder himself. Moses is the house. Jesus is the builder of the house. Therefore, Jesus is greater than Moses. And that's the basic idea. Verse 4, for every house is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God. If Jesus built the house, what does that say about Jesus? Now Moses was faithful in all God's house as a servant to testify to the things that were to be spoken later. But Christ is faithful over God's house as a son. And we are his house if indeed we hold fast our confidence and our boasting and our hope. Okay? Moses was a servant of God. Jesus is not a servant of God. He is a son of God. Therefore, he is greater than Moses. And this is going to be very important here, because what he's doing is he's basically comparing the new regime, the new thing that God is doing, with the old thing that God was doing. Okay? And part of being able to do that is he has to establish the notion that you can't have a lesser come in and change the greater. That's the idea. You can't have a lesser person, someone lesser than Moses, come in up in the Mosaic system. But if you have someone who's greater who can come in and up, who can come in and upend, he can do it. He actually can bring an entirely new thing, and that is, in fact, what he does as we move through the argument. Now, theologically speaking, one thing that's very interesting about this book, and very useful for us theologically, is the notion of rest, or the notion of the land promise. If we think about the Old Testament, we know that Abraham was promised land, all right? And Moses was supposed to bring them into the land and give them rest. And the idea of that rest was rest from enemies, rest from subjugation and whatnot. And so you think about the Mosaic system and you think, what is that supposed to bring about? That is supposed to bring about rest within the land. In chapter 4, a part of this heightening, this changeover of the greater from the lesser, the rest ultimately changes. This land promise is not a big deal in most of the New Testament. It is here. And what he does is essentially he spiritualizes it. What is the rest? The rest is no longer the land. The rest is Jesus. Let's take a look at chapter 4. Therefore, while promise of entering his rest still stands, let us fear lest any of you should seem to have failed to reach it. For good news came to us just as to them, but the message they heard did not benefit them because they were not united by faith. That theme's going to come up with those who listened. For we who have believed enter that rest. As he said, as I sworn my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Who's he talking about? Does anybody know? He's talking about Israel before they entered the land. These people who are stubborn will not enter my rest. Although his works were finished from the foundation of the world, for he has somewhere spoken of the seventh day in this way, and God rested on the seventh day from all his works. And again, in this passage, he said, they shall not enter my rest. Since, therefore, it remains for some to enter it, and those who formerly received the good news failed to enter because of disobedience. Again, he appoints a certain day, today, saying through David so long afterwards, in the words already quoted, today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. For if Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken of another day later. So then, there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For whoever has entered God's rest has rested from his works as God did from his. Let us therefore strive to enter that rest, so that no one may fall by the same sort of disobedience. For the word of God is living and active, sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing to the division of soul and the spirit, of joints and marrow, and discernment and thoughts and intentions of the heart. And no creature is hidden from his sight, but all are naked and exposed to the eyes of him to whom we must give account. A famous verse that's used to talk about Scripture and is not valid for that. What is this talking about? This is talking about apostasy. Let us strive to enter the rest and be obedient. God sees your heart. You cannot deceive him. Cannot deceive him. Do not be like the Israelites in the desert. That's the notion there. So he's talked some about Moses, but Moses will continue to come up in many ways for a number of chapters, because now he's going to switch here in the middle of chapter 4 to Jesus as high priest. Okay? Now, we think about who high priest was before, Aaron, right? Aaron and his descendants were supposed to be the priestly caste, the priestly group, and the high priest to be the one who goes into the Holy of Holies. The next thing he's going to do, and this is going to take a number of chapters, he's going to talk about the change in the priesthood and in the sacrifices. So let's see. How does he do it? Well, first he starts verse 14. Since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God. Let us hold fast to our confession. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who is in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. For every high priest was chosen among men is appointed to act in behalf of men in relation to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sin. Now think about this. He just said, let us draw near to the throne of grace. All right? How many people under the old covenant were able to draw really, really close to God? They had a physical, a physical layout of their worship center, right? How many people were able to really, really get close to God? One person, and always only one person. Yet he just said, let us all draw near. How are you going to do that? And so that's what he builds up. He does this by doing two things. One, he talks about his sacrifice as being greater than the sacrifices of Levi. Okay, Levi being a son of Abraham and therefore less than Abraham, but also appointed by Moses. But Jesus is greater than Moses. So therefore, Jesus could be a greater priest than Levi ever could be, because Jesus is greater than Moses. So that's essentially what you get in 5 and you get in 6. Also in 5 you have another note about apostasy, verse 11. We won't go into it. But we will read verse 5, chapter 5, verse 7. In the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverence. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. And being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him, being designated by God a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. Okay? So, priesthoods. The Aaronic priesthood had one high priest, and you've got him in the middle who can go into the Holy of Holies. And the next image is there's an outer group. They could come closer. They offered sacrifices. They helped the people approach God. Not that the people could really approach God, not as close as the high priest could. But they were there on the little, if you think in terms of layers of an onion, on the inside you've got the Holy of Holies and the high priest. And then outside the high priest, there's another layer of people. What happens if someone comes in and says, not only do we have a better high priest than any of the high priests you've had before, but we're going to peel away that entire outer layer, okay? That entire outer layer that separated, that stood between God and man, and then allowed people to go through into the Holy of Holies themselves by replacing it with a different priesthood. And that's where he goes. And you see the hint of it there in chapter 5, verse 10. When you get to chapter 7, he's all in. Now we're going to focus on Melchizedek. Now, if you remember your Old Testament, Melchizedek was given tithes by Abraham in Genesis. Okay? And this is another thing that he's going to make here, another point. If Abraham gave tithes to Melchizedek, who's greater? Melchizedek or Abraham? Answer, Melchizedek. Okay? And so if Jesus is a priest, as it also says, for example, in the Psalms, if you look at 5:6, he says in another place, you are the priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. If Jesus is therefore a priest in the order of Melchizedek, he is greater than Abraham. And Abraham is greater than Moses. And Moses is greater than Levi. Jesus is greater than all of those things. Chapter 7. For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, being the most priest of the Most High God, met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him. And to him Abraham apportioned a tenth part of everything. He is first, by translation of his name, king of righteousness, Melchizedek, that's king of righteousness. And then also king of Salem, Shalom, king of peace. He is without father or mother or genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but resembling the Son of God, he continues a priest forever. Okay? See how great this man was to whom Abraham the patriarch gave a tenth of the spoils, and those descendants of Levi who received the priestly office have a commandment in the law to take tithes from the people, that is, from their brothers, though these also are descended from Abraham. All right. But this man who does not have his descent from them received tithes from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. It is beyond dispute that the inferior is blessed by the superior. Melchizedek is the superior. He blessed the inferior Abraham. Jump to verse 15. This becomes even more evident when another priest arises in the likeness of Melchizedek, who has become a priest, not on the basis of a legal requirement concerning bodily descent, Aaron and his descendants, but by the power of an indestructible life. For it is witnessed of him, you are a priest forever, after the order of Melchizedek. For on the other hand, a former commandment is set aside because of its weakness and uselessness. For the law made nothing perfect, but on the other hand, a better hope is introduced, through which we draw near to God. Verse 22, skipping a little bit, this makes Jesus the guarantor of a better covenant. The former priests were many in number because they were prevented by death from continuing in office. But he holds his priesthood permanently because he continues forever. Consequently, he is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. For it was indeed fitting that we should have such a high priest, holy, innocent, unstained, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. He has no need, like those high priests, to offer sacrifices daily, first for his own sins and then for those of the people, since he did this once for all when he offered up himself. For the law appoints men in their weakness as high priest, but the word of oath, which came later than the law, appoints a son whom has made perfect forever. Okay. So our contrast are angels who mediated the old covenant, who are very powerful beings. Jesus is greater than them. Jesus is also greater than Moses. Jesus is also greater than Abraham. This also makes him greater, since he's greater than both Abraham and Moses. He is by definition greater than Levi. All right. Who was the son of Abraham, but whose office was established through Moses. Jesus is greater than all of these. So where's he going to go now? All right, where's the next move? And the next move is ultimately Jeremiah. And that is, if you look at verse 8 through 12, big long quote of Jeremiah, okay? And one of the things he said, and we've seen it in the readings a few times, is there is a problem with the old covenant. And this is exactly what Paul would argue in different words. All right, not that the old covenant was wrong. It's just that they couldn't keep it. Now, another argument that's in this, and maybe we'll read texts that actually say this, but it's in the book of Hebrews, is God made a covenant through Moses, right? Moses was the mediator of a covenant and established a priesthood with the people. If you change out the priesthood, you change out the covenant. That's one of his notions here. If you change out the priesthood, you necessarily change out the covenant. in verse 13 of chapter 8, in speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one obsolete. And what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. And that hints towards something, if we have time, which we won't, talks about why actually you should date this before AD 70. But we shall move on. Chapter 9, you've got this earthly holy place where you had, verse 1, regulations for worship and an earthly place of holiness. One thing that he talks about a lot is the old covenant as shadow of what's really going on. All right? Whenever a priest is sacrificing in the tabernacle, because he always talks about the tabernacle here. He never actually talks about the temple. When the priest is sacrificing in the tabernacle, what that's doing is that's testifying of heavenly realities and pointing towards those. The difference is those things are done on earth. And the high priest, whenever he approaches the Holy of Holies, he's approaching the Holy of Holies on earth. How is Jesus a better high priest than Aaron? Well, instead of approaching the Holy of Holies on earth, Jesus, the high priest, approaches God himself in heaven. He's not on earth looking up there. He's actually up there and can intercede directly, which is something that the high priest could never do, because those old covenant things were only images of what's in heaven, not the actual thing. Jesus is different. He ministers in the actual place. Not the figurative place, not the image. He's there, able to do it. Go ahead.
I just want to comment about that, because I don't know, 15, 17 years ago, I thought I made this great breakthrough, and I was wrong. So if you're fascinated or a student of philosophy, then you know about the Platonic forms. And so it's a belief, and all of a sudden you apply those ideas and you think, oh, it's just like the Platonic forms. You know, the real is not what's here. The real is what's there. The real is the form. And so I thought I had, and if you apply that, then you start, at least I thought I was getting all this magnificent insight into Holy Scripture from applying the ideas of a pagan Greek philosopher to Pauline ideas or apostolic ideas in Holy Scripture, and it's not the case. But his point is that's even more real. Jesus actually rose from the dead and actually ascended, and he's in heaven, not as some ethereal form. He really is there, and it's just as real. You might not see it, but Jesus is real, and he's actually in the presence of God and interceding on our behalf with God.
Amen.
Well, and the certainty, too, of the priest, you know, in the Old Covenant, you know, they tie a rope around the guy's neck, because you never know, he might die in there because of sin, and we can't go get him because we'll die when we go in there. So put a rope around him just in case. There's no uncertainty with Christ.
Right.
God is well pleased with him. He is going to be interceding. Nothing is going to remove him from that office.
Amen. Much better priest. The next thing he's going to start doing is we're going to shift essentially to our last topic within the book. And we have so much time to do it. The last topic in the book is what's the deal? So Jesus is greater than angels. He's greater than Abraham. He's greater than Aaron. He's greater than Moses. He is fulfilling his role as priest of Melchizedek, an eternal priesthood in the presence of God. Okay? How shall we then live? What is our response to that? What should be? And what he'll do at this point is he is now going to shift from what is to proper response. Okay? Now, if we look at this in chapter 10, we see another one of his apostasy passages. All right? 10:26. For if we go on sinning deliberately after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a fearful expectation of judgment, and a fury of fire that will consume the adversaries. Anyone who has set aside the law of Moses dies without mercy, on the evidence of two or three witnesses. How much worse punishment do you think will be deserved by the one who trampled underfoot the Son of God, and has profaned the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified, and has outraged the Spirit of grace? For we know him who said, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay." And again, "The Lord will judge his people." It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. But recall the former days when, after you were enlightened, you endured a hard struggle with sufferings, sometimes being publicly exposed to reproach and affliction, and sometimes being partners with those who so treated. For you had compassion on those in prison, and you joyfully accepted the plundering of your property, since you knew that you yourselves had a better possession and an abiding one. Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward, for you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what is promised. For yet a little while, and the coming one will come, but will not delay. But my righteous one shall live by faith. And if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who shrink back and are destroyed, but of those who have faith and preserve their souls. And at this point, he switches into the topic of faith. Just as a note, there is zero contrast in this book, just as there is in Paul. There's zero contrast in book, or I should say, it's just that there isn't in Paul. Zero contrast between faith and obedience. None. Zero. Zip. Zilch. In Paul, the contrast is law and faith. Never, ever obedience and faith. Never. Always law and faith. Same here. If you read through the chapter on faith, you're going to find a great deal of obedience. All right? A great deal of it. Because that's not the contrast. What's the contrast for Hebrews? The contrast for Hebrews is faith and apostasy. Who has real faith? Well, those who do not throw away their confidence, and they endure until the end. Not unlike the book of Revelation, right? Which we'll be seeing here in a month or two, all right? Not unlike that. Who are those who receive the crown of life? Those who endure to the end. Chapter 11, you get the hall of faith, right? We've all read this. You've got lots of people. Here's Abel versus Cain. Here's Enoch. Here's Noah. Here's Abraham. Here's Moses. And many, many more. All right, and then eventually he says, yes, there's too many. I'm just not going to talk about them all because there's a lot of people to follow, at least in terms of their example of faith. Chapter 12, therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. And this next chapter, this next section is in mine subtitled, Do Not Grow Weary. All right? And that's really the point of the book. All right? For the apostasy passages, and this is what we'll end on, for the apostasy passages, we get uncomfortable with them because we do believe that when God saves someone, really saves someone, he keeps them saved. All right? The apostasy passages, they don't, like, wait a minute, what about these people? They seem to be Christians, but he's telling them not to fall away. And if they fall away, it seems like there's a terrible judgment waiting for them. I don't know what to do with this. I really do not. What I am confident we cannot do, and this is how some people handle it, all right? What I'm confident we cannot do is we cannot soften the judgments and say, oh, he's not really talking about eternal punishment of any sort. He's just talking about something temporal. That's actually a fairly common way of approaching this, and that makes no sense out of this book, in my opinion. I think you missed the point of the book. Because one of the points of the book, All right, if you want a central thesis, all right, is if you want at least for who, in terms of who God is and how we should respond, it is Christ is better than everything. Therefore, do not fall away. Okay, that's it. It's not just a book about theology, right? You can read a book about theology and a modern book about theology and totally not get anything about perseverance in it. That's not this book. This is not an abstract book of theology that's just talking about God. It is talking about who Jesus is and says, therefore, you cannot fall away. You think people under Moses got it bad when they disobeyed? You're not disobeying Moses. You're disobeying Jesus, right? And so however you handle those, that's not the right way to go. It's to say, oh, it's not really that bad. It's just temporal punishment, but still people will make it to heaven, quote unquote. That's the wrong way to take this. It completely destroys, I think, the point of this book. Because the point of this book is not, let's just have theology talk time. It's given theology, make it. Make it to the end. Do not be disobedient. All right? And he's confident you're going to make it. He says that a number of times. Guys, the problem is not you. You're going to make it. You are. All right? But part of that is probably the judgment. You're going to make it. Because if you don't make it, you recognize how bad it's going to be. Because God, he did not have mercy on these people who didn't want to obey in the wilderness. All right? He didn't have mercy. He killed all of them, except those who were obedient. He killed them all. What do you think happens when somebody does the same thing and is disobedient, who decides, you know, yeah, I believe in Jesus, but I'm not really going to follow him? No. That's worse than the people in the wilderness. Much worse. Yeah.
Do you like the passage of the sower who went out to sow the seed, and it speaks about one that fell on the rocks, and it sprang up quickly with joy, but stuff happened. There was no way.
Yeah.
Like, it seems like he's warning against that.
Or those who grew up in thorns, and the thorns choked them out, right? Could very well be.
Because both of them, for a time, they seem to be growing and doing well, you know.
And that would be like, you know, some people, the two main ways I've seen this solved is, one, you make the punishments less severe, which I totally think is the wrong way to go. The other way is to go and say, these aren't Christians. These aren't redeemed, have the Spirit, elect eternally, all that. The only problem is, as you well know, because we've discussed it, right? There's some language in there that you go, how can you apply that language to non-Christians? Because that sure seems like exactly what you'd say about a Christian. And I don't have an answer.
In our men's, we just finished our men's book study. And those of you that read that book, probably remember this, I believe it was Dr. Bill Bright, who had prayed publicly, God, kill me before you would let me commit adultery on my wife. And if you think about adultery in the Old Testament being repeatedly used as a metaphor for unfaithfulness to God, unfaithfulness to this marital institution on earth is a